Good Monday morning. Hope your morning is off to a pretty good start so far. It is 10:07 right now. Hi there, and welcome to the second hour of our show this morning. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon. And here's what's ahead of the show for you today. Another hour of Science Files is coming up this hour, and astrophysicist Rob Thacker is back with us this morning, and I'll make the introduction in just a moment. Next hour, it's your turn to sound off. We've got our first open hour of the week coming up at 11. We call it Manic Monday, and as always, anything goes. After the news at noon, the Nova Scotia Sport Hall of Fame will introduce its Class of 2019 inductees at a ceremony this morning. And the Hall's Bruce Rainey will tell us who will be honored this year. And we'll hear another Halifax History Moment when historian and author Blair B. joins me this afternoon. But this hour, it is 10:07. It is time for Science Files. And back with us this morning is St. Mary's University astrophysicist Dr. Rob Thacker. Dr. Rob, good morning to you.
Good morning, good morning.
And how are you doing this fine Monday morning?
Pretty good. Actually, if you got me yesterday, my eyes were streaming. And yeah. It was really bad allergies yesterday. I don't know if some tree pollen or something.
I think it's a big pollen year from what I understand.
Yeah, so recovered, fully recovered and
good.
Ready to go.
Good. Woo. Yeah, because my eyes have been kind of, just get real watery, right?
Talking to counselors will do that to you.
True. Yeah, true. Maybe it's not allergies after all.
Oh, David's gone.
Yeah, there he is. NASA is warning that meteors pose a major threat to this planet of ours. And I'm reading here there are agencies already testing out ways to defend against these meteor threats by using lasers or by ramming spacecraft into them. And I mention that because, as well, Canadian astronomers are seeking potentially dangerous space rocks in a nearby swarm of meteors. It's called the Torrid Meteor Swarm.
Yeah.
And they're looking for potentially big rocks in this swarm could be a risk.
That's right.
So this has suddenly become, I don't call it an urgent matter, but suddenly it's very much in the news. If later, are we at some risk here now?
I'm personally not worried about it. So streams that actually form... streams of material from comets will be the things that actually form all of these beautiful sort of like meteor storms that we see periodically during the year.
Right? Yep.
And so within those particular trails, as the comet goes around, it leaves the material. And then there'll be regions that are slightly more dense than others, right? So with this particular thing, as Taurus, as you said, there's like an area that we know is denser. So we're interested in looking at that in more detail. See if we can find any somewhat bigger lumps. Most of the things that you see up as a shooting star, you're talking about pebble-sized objects. Suddenly, they're gone. Very pretty, fun to see one, but then they're not any real threat. Hmm. When you get up to things that are a few tens of meters in size, which are actually fairly difficult to see with a telescope, then you can start looking at things that release quite a bit of energy. So, for example, Chelyabinsk, which was like 4 or 5 years ago in Russia, that was probably something the size of a school bus, maybe a bit bigger. And that was a fair amount of energy. So those kind of things are actually pretty difficult to see with a telescope. So training a telescope in the direction of something where we might expect to see something is always a good idea. So if we're pointing at the particular swarm, we think that we'll have maybe a few more things than normal, then we might find something. But, you know, the probability is probably fairly low. You maybe get things that are sort of like a few meters at most, and then you'll get nice great big fireballs that light the sky up for a couple of seconds or so.
Yeah. I'm reading here that NASA is currently moving towards a goal of detecting and tracking 90% of near-Earth asteroids larger than 140 meters or more. Models indicate there are about 25,000 of these sized objects whose orbits come in close proximity to Earth. So, I mean, this is kind of like rolling the dice,
140
right?
meters is big.
Yeah.
Right? 140 meters is a big object. If you have something like that hitting the atmosphere at very high speed, so tens of thousands of kilometers an hour, then that is going to actually have a significant impact if it were to land over a populated area. Flip side is... two-thirds of the world's surface is covered in ocean anyway. So you immediately know that the probability of it hitting a sort of like built-up area or a city and so on is fairly low. So that's another one of the reasons why we have to look for them, but you can't lose sleep about it at night. That kind of thing, it's going to be too late before you find it anyway, right? It's the much bigger things, the few kilometer-sized things. Those things we actually think we have a pretty good handle on, having seen most of those. But the smaller ones, yeah, they still pose a threat, right? Because there's more of them.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, the probability that they hit something is still fairly low.
In earlier this month, SpaceX was awarded a $69 million U.S. government contract to provide launch services for NASA's double asteroid redirection test mission, which will test out the ability to deflect an asteroid by colliding a spacecraft into it at high speed.
Yep.
This is not science fiction. This is what they're actually working on.
This is completely reasonable. And so the idea is, we've talked about this before. So the main thing that you want to be able to do with an asteroid is to find it early enough.
Yeah.
And if you find it early enough, just a little nudge is all you need to actually sort of move it away from the Earth. Whereas if you find it just as it's sort of like coming in from the moon or something like that, it's tough, too late. I mean, that's really too late to be able to do anything. You've only got a couple of days before it hits you. Whereas if you're catching something that's a few sort of years away from potentially hitting the Earth, then you really can just give it a small nudge and you're done. The other thing is to put something on it that's literally throwing things off. And as crazy as it may sound, if you throw enough things off, it's just like a rocket. Right, same idea. Rockets work because you're throwing material out the back of them. That's what allows it to go forward. It's something called the conservation of momentum. Same thing. If you can put a system down onto an asteroid a few years before it hits the Earth and just what we call a mass driver, throwing stuff off and just slowly knocking the asteroid off course.
Okay, we may have to deal with something like that by April 2027, according to this story here now, because says here, the day after this particular asteroid and its hashtag 2019 PDC was spotted, NASA's impact monitoring systems identify several future dates when this asteroid could hit. Both systems agree the most likely date is 29 April 2027, with a very low impact, probably at about 1 in 50,000.
No, it's not worth worrying about.
Okay.
No. Really, I mean, seriously, 1 in 50,000 is not worth
worrying about. So I won't mark that date on my calendar then, April 2027.
If there was something that was a significant impact risk, we would hear about it because we would be doing something about it. I mean, it's not crazy that if we knew something was likely to hit us in 5 years' time, we could think about intercept trajectories and sort of do things if we had a few years to do something. So the fact that people aren't sort of worrying about this, it's just not too much of an issue.
But it was an asteroid hit that wiped out the dinosaurs, right?
Yes, but that was a big asteroid. I mean, there we're talking about something that was several kilometers across,
really?
At least. Yeah. And so that when that hits, you're talking way more energy than the biggest nuclear weapons we've ever detonated. In fact, there may have been so much energy in that particular asteroid that it literally popped a whole bunch of volcanoes around the world as well.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting. 10:14, but rest assured that Not in the distant future or the near future will we have to worry about an asteroid hit.
I mean, look, we are, so obviously the people who work in this area take it very seriously. Government is putting nominal amounts of money. Are we putting enough money into it? Some people think we aren't, because the point is, if you have something really big hit the Earth, the damage it does is just truly ridiculous. And so the risk to humanity is significant from that perspective, right? But in terms of the probability of that happening, it's very low. Right. So it's a question of how you sort of like weigh up the two things.
All right. He is Dr. Rob Thacker. This is Science Files. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob here this morning, give us a call, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. You can send us a question via email as well. Dave has done that. We'll ask that question in a moment. rick.howe@news957.com or tweet us a question. Our Twitter handle @TheRickHowe Show. 10:15 is our time right now. We'll take a quick break and we'll be back to hear more from Dr. Rob right after this. Ten 18 on a Monday morning, Science Files. And Dr. Rob is with us here till 11 o'clock. He's an astrophysicist at St. Mary's University. And David has emailed us a question here this morning. He says, Dr. Thacker really didn't answer my question last time, which was, what is the purpose of the Lunar Gateway? Is it pointless, he wonders? Wouldn't it be better to put our energy into building a base on the moon, asks David here this morning. What's your reply, Rob?
Well, it depends upon what you actually want to do. So the point of the gateway was originally called something else. It was originally called the Deep Space Gateway. And so the point of the Deep Space Gateway was to have a staging post for going further into space. And so the whole idea of going to Mars is great, a lot of fun. We haven't been to anywhere beyond the moon, so let's go to Mars. But it's a long, long way, right? So what we need to learn, and there's uniform agreement on this, we need to learn more about traveling in deep space for significant periods of time. I mean, even the whole thing of putting like five people into a confined space and letting them duke it out with one another, or say hate one another after a few months of being together, that's something that we have to learn. And so we've done sort of experiments like that on the ground, but they're not the same because there's always this possibility you can get out and so on. So So originally the Deep Space Gateway was going to be this space station, for want of a better term, out in space. And that would allow us to sort of send missions out to sort of like 3-4 weeks at a time, going out, they're coming back, learning about all of those things. And so that was the idea. And then people thought, well, why don't we put it around the moon? And so it's now been renamed the Lunar Orbital Platform, right? And so the point of that is really just a staging post for going out to deep space. Now, if you want to go back to the moon, then I agree that's probably not a sensible thing to do, right? The sensible thing, if you want to go back to the moon, is to actually go to the moon rather than going around it. Mm. So in this particular case, they're talking about using the Lunar Gateway as a way to go down to the lunar surface as well. But it's real. The reason behind the idea in the first place was really to have this staging post for doing long-term missions. Now, so a number of different, like Blue Origin was talking about going to the moon. China was talking about having a moon base. Now the US is like, well, let's go back to the moon as well. So within literally a few months of deciding upon what the strategy was going to be, now Mike Pence is saying, no, we're going to go back to the surface, and that's the key thing for us.
So is it possible they could build a base on the moon?
It's possible. I haven't seen the complete plan, so I can't comment on it, but certainly working on the moon and working in the lunar environment is an interesting problem in and of itself, right? Particularly people are interested in what possibilities there are for, I mean, we're going to say it, mining, but nonetheless, living on the moon in a really difficult environment is a real challenge, and that's one of the things that people are interested in learning more about.
What could be mined on the moon? What might be there?
So one of the things that always comes up is this rare isotope of helium, helium 3 or 4, I can't remember which one it is. So that comes up often. That would be useful for various, I think it's using for nuclear fusion reactions. So, but titanium is a possibility as well. So, but they're not sure, right? Because we've done a lot of surface topography, but we don't know really what's below the surface. I mean, there could be, well, I mean, there could be. There's going to be meteorites that have hit the surface that contain lots of rare metals and things like that. I mean, the moon is literally soaking up those impacts. Yeah.
So they haven't dug into the moon like they're doing on Mars now with some of their rovers there.
Well, we've taken some samples. I mean, Apollo took a few samples and so on, but we've not gone really deep down, no.
Interesting. Brian's given us a call this morning. He wants to talk about space programs. Good morning, Brian.
Hi. I'm just reading an interesting book by Annie Jacobson. Have you heard of her? She wrote a book called Operation Paperclip.
I'm sorry I haven't, but it's
called the Secret Intelligence Program that brought Nazi scientists to America. Like Wiener von Braun, we all know that he also built the V-1 and V-2 rockets.
Yep.
But so British were bombing the heck out of Germany, too, with their bombers. But his real crime, which only came out after his death, was that NASA knew all about him, but they needed his rocket expertise, is that he used slave labor to build his rockets.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he encouraged slave labor, and he didn't give a care about how they were treated. They usually lasted about 3 or 4 months. They were beaten to death. They were starved to death. And so he'll keep asking for more and more slave laborers to help build his rockets. So he was
a nice person, unconvicted
war criminal.
Yeah.
But because of his rocket expertise, he was very good at hiding his past, and then NASA hided his past. NASA knew about him.
Yeah.
American generals knew about him. And not only that, but the biological weapon program and the chemical weapon program that was being done during the Cold War, many of them were bought over German scientist doctors, mostly, who would experiment on nitrogen cat inmates were hired by the American government to produce biological and chemical weapons for the United States.
At the end of the war, there was a big rush on by both the American and Russian forces to try to, again, get German scientists with their particular groups. And you're right in regards to Werner von Braun, but you know, without
there has been a fair amount of discussion about von Braun.
Yeah. Thanks for the call there, but say that again.
There's been a lot of discussion about von Braun in particular. So, I mean, I'm struggling to find the right words. I mean, the war crimes that he was involved in and so on, especially using slave labor and so on. I mean, that has been talked about. And it's a good question. I mean, what should we do in terms of the knowledge that we've used from people who have done really horrible things? And one of the challenges there is you can't put the genie back in the box, right? But I don't know. It's a good question.
It is a good question. Robert just emailed and said, many years ago, there was a huge forest in Russia where tens of thousands of trees were knocked over. Was that a meteorite?
And I think Tunguska. Yeah.
And that was, what year was that? That was
1904.
Yeah, right, in Siberia,
right? Yeah, that's right. And hundreds of miles.
He says, if so, what can we equate the energy to? If it compares.
Oh, so that one was actually equivalent to a fairly big nuclear weapon detonating about, I think it was 30,000 feet in the air. So that was equivalent to a several megaton weapon, they estimate.
So why would that have not been, I don't know, planet risking?
It's not planet risking because even a single nuclear weapon, as devastating it would be, is not going to be able to destroy the planet. But that Tunguska, we think, is about a once every couple of 100 years event kind of thing. So that would have been several hundred meters across, probably.
All right. Katie's got a question from a caller who wonders, why are asteroid strikes on the moon are only at a certain depth? He says it doesn't make sense that the bigger asteroids would leave bigger imprints. This is a caller who is at work and couldn't stay on hold.
So my guess, well, would they be at certain depths? I mean, I would guess they would be at varying depths depending upon the impact speed of them, right? But the overall makeup of the moon itself will actually determine the sort of local density of material on the moon will determine how far down something is going to go ultimately.
Okay.
I mean, that's probably fairly regular, so it will come back to the impact speed as well.
Nora with an email question, wondering, can a refrigerator heat a room? And now when I saw this, I said, what kind of question is that? But you say this is a great question.
Actually a really great question.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay, so, explain.
So if it's a heat wave, right, yep. And you want to stay cool,
are
you
going to
open your refrigerator and sit next to that or not?
I would think that would be something you would want to do, saying no.
No. So in fact, what happens with a refrigerator is it's a heat pump, right? So it's literally pumping the heat out of the cooler interior and putting heat into the room. So it can't do that perfectly efficiently as well. Yeah. And so the net effect will be, as it uses the energy to run and you run the heat pump, you end up heating up the room, right?
Okay.
So that's one of the reasons why when you buy a new refrigerator or a new fridge freezer, you'll see on the back, leave space for the cooling element and so on. So that's how it's actually taking that heat and releasing that heat. So it's actually a really good question. I mean, I've had this argument with my sister, actually, about she said, well, it's because we many years ago when I lived in London and she also lived in London, I would go down and it was a heat wave. It was something like 35 degrees and there's no air conditioning in London other than in a few stores and so on. And she said, well, let's go and open the refrigerator. And I'm like, no, we're not going to do that because we'll end up heating the whole room up because it'll constantly be running to try and keep it cool.
And I would have been, she would have been like me, and I would have said, that's crazy.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can kind of keep yourself cool in the sort of like small area with inside it, but you're actually heating up the whole room around you.
Very interesting. Yeah. So that is not that,
that's a great question.
Not a dumb question.
Yeah,
very
that's
good.
A great question.
Coming up to 10:28, we're going to break here for a news update, and then more with Dr. Rob Thacker from St. Mary's University. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob this morning, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. You can also email us our email address, rick.howe@news957.com, or even tweet us a question, our Twitter handle at The Rick Howe Show. We're going to break for that news update, and then more Science Files with Dr. Rob. We're back right after the news. Of course, that Elton John and the movie called Rocket Man about his life and times. Have you seen that yet?
I have not.
Are you an Elton John fan? No,
I'm not really an Elton John fan. Got to be honest. Great musician, but
little strange guy.
Yeah, not a particularly nice guy to a lot of people.
So. Yeah, indeed. But no question, he is a great musician. Rocket Man, the name of the movie. This is Science Files, though. He is Dr. Rob Thacker. He's an astrophysicist at St. Mary's University here in Halifax. And if you've got a question or a comment for us this morning, give us a call, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. And Ken's on the line. He's got a question for us this morning. Morning, Ken.
Hi, guys. Three things. Rob, I think there's a launch this week by SpaceX, but I'm not sure. It's either this week or next week.
Mm-hmm.
Number two is July 20th is getting here faster. So I've left my number with Katie. If you want to have a little five-minute talk about what we should do, because for an event, to do an event, we're going to have to get, a few things. You're probably going to get a cake or something.
Okay.
So we can have a brainstormer about that. And number three, there's a famous story about the Tamagusta, I forget.
Tunguska.
The asteroid hit in Russia. Yeah.
In Russia. What happened was when that asteroid or comet came over, it It went over to London and Paris. And supposedly, this has been documented, they came over and it made a U-turn. And it went over these populated areas and then went up to Siberia. It's just, and of course, the subtext is this was an alien spaceship, and the guy to save the people, or the alien to save the people, made the turn. Anyway, that's just a little,
yeah, we don't believe that, though,
yeah,
do we?
No.
Thanks very much.
I appreciate it. Did it cross paths over Europe?
That's the first time I've heard that. I'd have to do orbital trajectories. I think it's unlikely that it would have been over London or Paris, because that's a long way from Siberia,
yeah.
And this thing has actually got to come into the atmosphere and so on. But it depends upon the timing. They may have been able to see something streaming by, but it wouldn't have been that bright until it got into the actual atmosphere.
Yeah, and he mentioned the possibility, and again, far-fetched as it was, that an alien on board was
doing
this.
Thank you. You're learning something. Thank you.
But there is a belief that one of those oblong space rocks that came from outside our galaxy might have been an alien spaceship.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What's the latest on that?
That's
anything?
Oumuamua. Yeah. So, yeah.
No news on that at all?
It's gone. That's
oh,
the thing,
it?
Right?
Okay. So they checked us out, and now they're back to report,
yeah,
right?
It literally was on a very, very fast flyby. That's one of the reasons why we think it comes from outside the solar system as well, because of the speed that it came in. But there's not any more research we can do about it, and we certainly can't send a rocket to catch up with it. It's just too fast.
Might it come back our way again sometime?
No, not at all. It's just gone.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Let's talk about what's going on in Jupiter. And the question, the headline in this story says, what's happening to Jupiter's great red spot? And this is basically the belief that this red spot on the planet Jupiter is a 400-year-old storm that
it's
now?
It's a giant storm. I mean, the chemistry of why it's red is kind of interesting and curious, and people have been studying that. But the thing is, it's getting smaller, and it's been visibly getting smaller for a number of years as well. So there's been some really interesting activity around the spot over the last few weeks, and it's looking like things are actually sort of like coming off it and actually dissipating off it, and that's getting rid of it. So the sort of like idea is that bits of it are just literally going away and being nibbled away. So when you look at the pictures that people drew of it hundreds of years ago when we first saw it, it was much bigger. Now, you can argue, were they exaggerating it or whatever? I don't know. Probably not. And now we've been able to measure it photographically for a number of years. We definitely know it's getting smaller, and there definitely seems to be more activity around its edges right now.
Boy, we think our spring's been crappy. Imagine a 400-year-old storm here. What's the forecast today, dear?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's kind of amazing. Amazing to be alive now if it's going to go away in the next sort of like few years, because we'll be able to study that in detail.
Why is this red? And I'm looking here, the swirling red clouds. Is that the reason for the redness of the spot?
Oh, you got me. I can't remember what the red particular chemistry is. I can look it up, but I can't remember off the top of my head.
Okay. But apparently you can, with a good set of binoculars or a telescope, you can see
see this with a very small telescope. It is one of the things that really stands out. And so so Jupiter and Saturn are the two things that if you look through a telescope, you can't but go, wow, when you see them. Saturn's a little bit different because you go from seeing what looks like a star to seeing something that has rings. Whereas Jupiter, if you have a still enough atmosphere and you have a good enough telescope, then you go from literally a star to seeing a star with the four Galilean moons around it. And if you're lucky, you'll see the bands across Jupiter as well. You need a fairly good telescope to do that, right? So, I'm doing homework. And so the possible origin of the color is, I was going to say tholins. So these are particularly unusual organic compound that's related to different processes in radiation, basically from the sun and so on, called tholins, and possibly something called ammonium hydrosulfide and acetylene as well.
So what kind of storm would this be? Like a windstorm or a rainstorm?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the winds are incredibly high in Jupiter's atmosphere anyway. So what you're seeing is basically just a centralized storm system that's basically going round and round and round for a very, very long time. There's also subcells within it as well. There are beautiful, beautiful close-up images taken by Juno showing all of the interior structure of the storm as well.
So this is basically the idea is this storm is is dissipating. At some point down the road, red spot will disappear completely.
That's what it looks like. I mean, the bigger question for me is, why did it form in the first place?
Yeah, and this is it. This is again, it says here, the Great Red Spot is massive, nearly 13,000 kilometers in diameter. That's a big storm.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yes, indeed. 10:38 is the time right now. And Mark, with an email question, does the speed of light vary depending on certain factors like density? And if it does, is the universe expanding at different rates? Does light slow when it bends?
Okay.
Number of questions here from
Mark this morning. Those are good questions, and they hint at something that I think is worth answering as well. So the short answer is, in the vacuum of space, even if you start putting more atoms and so on in there, that's not going to change the speed of light too much, right? Particularly at visible wavelengths. You can actually impact the speed of light at radio wavelengths and so on through the interstellar medium. That is known, and we have actually used that to estimate distances to things. It's kind of a neat, you can use delay time between different parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. And so, having said all of that, if you do start putting light through different media like water, then it does slow down. Right. And so you can actually see a certain kind of radiation called Cherenkov radiation that's associated with light going more slowly, only by a sort of like fractional amount in water versus in a vacuum and so on. So the short answer is, in the vacuum of space, you can slow it at certain wavelengths, but not a whole lot. And then in water, definitely visible wavelengths go more slowly. So, it is impacted. All of that is related to the electromagnetic fields associated with the light propagating and the electromagnetic fields of the things that it's propagating through.
Okay. Yeah. 10:40 is the time. Jonathan just fired off a question via email. Good morning, Dr. Thacker. He writes, wondering if you've tuned into the HBO series Chernobyl.
Haven't, but I've certainly heard people talking about it.
He says, if you have, would you consider this a pretty accurate account of what occurred during a nuclear plant blowing up? And I haven't seen this either, just read a little bit about it. Chernobyl is still very much a no-go zone, isn't it?
Oh, very much. I mean, that thing is going to be radioactive for tens of thousands of years.
But animals are making, their animals are coming back.
Yeah, so you can't stop the animals, basically. They will come back, and then if there's still sort of like nuggets of radiation in there that they go up to and get into sort of like around the sarcophagus area, then yeah, they could still have exposure. But I think overall, I mean, there's very close monitoring of it. And as I said, the sarcophagus is enclosing pretty much all of it pretty effectively now.
But it'd be interesting, I'd like to get, see the series number one.
No, I would like to see it too.
Yeah, and see some more detail on the impact, not only on animal life and reproduction, but on humans as well.
Yeah.
10:41 is the time, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Did an ancient supernova prompt human ancestors to walk upright is the question asked on the silencedaily.com website.
Yeah, okay.
Tell me what this ancient supernova is.
So this is a really interesting story, and it actually speaks to many, many different things, one of which is how stories break in the media.
Okay.
Right, so I'm going to tease you a little bit. So this is written by one of the co-authors, is a guy called Adrian Mulott, who actually worked in my field for a number of years. He's retired now, so he was doing computer simulations of how galaxies form and things like that. And he's a smart guy at the University of Kansas, has done a lot of work promoting science in Kansas. And now he's retired. He's doing different things.
Yep.
And so he wrote a paper looking at the impact of a supernovae 7 or 8 million years ago, a few tens of light years away, and what that would do to our atmosphere.
Now, a supernova, it's an exploding star?
Exploding star, so a lot of energy. And so he then did the calculations of the radiation that would come from that and what that would do to the atmosphere. And so the conclusion was, on the basis of his calculations, which are reasonable, was that there would actually be what's called an ionizing effect on our atmosphere. And that would mean that very high-energy protons would come out of the supernovae and then bonk into atoms in our atmosphere and actually take an electron out, leaving a positively charged remnant and the electron, which has a negative charge.
Okay.
Why is that interesting?
Why?
Because for electricity to travel in lightning down to the surface of the Earth, you need a conduction area, which means you need charges. So with regular lightning storms, what happens is you get what's called a voltage potential difference from the cloud to the ground. And then eventually that gets high enough to literally strip electrons out of atoms and then cause the electric current to flow from, I think it's from the ground upwards actually, but anyway, it doesn't matter. And so if you have all of these currents already potentially allowed to transfer because there's ionization, then you could have more lightning storms.
Okay.
Right? And so the thesis goes something like this, right? You have this event 7 million years ago, then you start having more lightning storms, then you start having more fires that burn up the forest and turn it into savanna grassland in Africa. And then the thesis then, which is literally fairly throwaway because the paper is really about the connection between wildfires and supernovae.
Yeah.
And then he said, well, you know, maybe that might be the thing that spurs hominids, these sort of like ancestors of ours that were ape-like,
yeah,
to start standing on two legs so they can see over the fires and run between the trees more quickly.
Oh, okay.
Right. And it was just a throwaway thing, primarily at the end of the paper. And this got taken up and run with by the media. It was like, oh, good, exploding stars make humans stand on humans' ancestors stand on two legs. And it's like, that's not really what the paper is about. It's more about the connection and doing the calculations of the overall ionization rate of the atmosphere.
But right? Here's a sidebar story to that.
I
think it was either on Nova or with Suzuki or one of those science programs on television.
Mm-hmm.
It was a group of people in Turkey. In a remote village in Turkey, who still went from point A to point B on all fours. And there was video and everything. It was a legit science show. Now, it was like Nova or on PBS or something along those lines. And this was a number of years ago. And I thought it was absolutely fascinating. Whole families that would, again, be, you know, on all fours as they, you know, went out for food or hunting and all those kinds of things.
So hold on. You're saying that when they're sort of in their local area, they're bipedal?
Yeah, yeah.
And then when they want to go a long distance, they turn into quadrupeds?
Well, they do both, yeah, that's right. But their method of traveling any distance was to on all, you know, like all fours.
Mm,
it was bizarre.
Okay, I'd have to
see. I know
see
you're
that.
Skeptical I'm, here, yeah, I know, but I'm telling you.
I've got the Spock raised eyebrows.
I saw it with my own two eyes.
Well, okay, you've said that before about some things.
That's true. 10:45 is the time.
Sure, I'd have to see it.
I'm going to try to find this online here to see it just to prove my point. But yeah, right now, we'll take another quick break. 10:45, he is Dr. Rob Thacker. This is Science Files. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We're back with more right after this. Coming up now to 10:49. Dr. Rob is with us here on a Monday morning. This is Science Files. And just before we get into a couple of other topics, we did go online to check out this possibility. And it's a true story. But it's not, part of the evolutionary process. This was, well, you explain here, Dr.
Yeah, Rob. So we went online very quickly and found this. So it is a Kurdish family who have a specific genetic let's call it an issue. They're somewhat mildly intellectually disabled as well. And so they can't balance on two legs, right? And so for them, the only way of them moving around quickly is to actually go to be a quadruped. And so this is, like I said, it is just something that is inherited apparently within that family. So it's not an example of devolution or something like that. Evolution going backwards, devolution. So anyway, but this is a very specific family trait.
Okay. Rick with a comment here this morning. He says, I thought about these heat pumps that are universally used throughout the world. Would this have the same effect for global warming as a refrigerator in a room? In other words, net zero on climate change.
My suspicion is the overall impact of heat pumps is not going to be too bad. The bigger concern you have on the environmental perspective is what the refrigerant is, right? That's the main thing, making sure we have the right chemicals in there. I don't know. It would be an interesting calculation to do, certainly in certain places. But I know that when people have studied whether it's better to live in a hot climate with cooling or a cold climate with heating, it's always a hot climate with cooling that's the better place to live.
Okay.
Right, from an energy perspective.
Let's talk about pollution in space.
Yeah.
And again, more and more satellites are being launched, and there's talk about the new drone technology potentially becoming space technology as well. And obviously, this is a problem.
Yeah, no. So this is a story that's actually very close to my heart, and I had been wondering about this for a number of months and had contacted my colleagues. So with Elon Musk having this idea of building what's called the Starlink constellation, and that is a whole satellite constellation, which is potentially several thousand satellites.
Really?
Yep, several thousand satellites.
And what's the point of that?
So that you can have uniform coverage of satellite internet across the entire globe.
About the internet, okay.
Right? Yep. And so when I first heard about this over a year ago now, I got in contact with some colleagues and said, well, you know, we have about 2,000 active satellites right now. There's probably a similar number that are in graveyard orbits and so on. And I said to my colleagues, well, how much processing do you do to remove these satellite tracks? And they said, well, you know, for anything up in space, right, at a certain height, like the Hubble Space Telescope, every now and again we get a track. We don't worry about it too much. They're not too bad because it's already up in space anyway. But yes, it can happen. But for things on the ground, people are taking out satellite tracks all the time, right? And so what is an issue is the time that you take the image. So when you're in the Earth's shadow, deep in the Earth's shadow, so remember the Earth rotates and basically the front that's facing the sun moves away at nighttime and is facing away from the sun at nighttime. And so in that situation, the only thing you have to worry about with satellites is those that are at such an angle that they reflect the sun's light back down onto the Earth. So it's a bit of a problem just as you're going into nighttime and just as you're coming into daylight as well, around twilight times. And so it depends upon the angle of the particular satellite, the person, and the sun. That's the thing that you have to calculate.
Yep.
And so the long and the short of it is, with the proposed number of Starlink satellites being a few thousand, potentially that's more satellites up in the sky than there are visible stars.
Really?
Right?
Yeah.
But they're not all going to be visible at the same time, right? So there may be at most a few hundred visible at a specific time with the idea of this current deployment strategy. And now initially Musk said, you astronomers, you're just trying to cause trouble for everyone. It won't impact astronomy in any way. Go away. And everyone was like, well, no, Elon, actually, you're talking out your butt on this one. It will impact astronomy, right? And so he said, okay, yeah, it will. But as the satellites deploy to their correct height and they put their solar panels out in the proper orientation, it shouldn't be too much of an issue because you always want to be orienting your solar panels towards the sun to get maximum efficiency, and then they won't bounce back down, right? So in the end, there will be a bit of an impact. But the bigger question people have been saying is, how does he have the right to actually go and put up several thousand things in the sky? And the short answer is he has to get approval for every launch he does.
He'll
be getting approval from the US government to do the launch. So if you want to get angry with anyone, you get angry with the US government for approving the launches.
Yeah.
Right.
But what about as well the risk to the International Space Station or spaceships blasting up there?
So these are actually quite low. I suspect they're even somewhat lower than the International Space Station, or I don't know for sure. They will know the precise trajectories that they're on, and they will be able to set them up in such a way that they know. The bigger concern is whether they do properly deorbit. So there has to be a plan for deorbiting these things. These are much smaller satellites than normal. They're only sort of like 500 pounds. And so there has to be a plan for taking them back down. In theory, that should have all been done. They all carry their own little propellant.
As opposed to just crashing to the Earth.
They're going to burn up,
yeah.
Right? They're small enough, like a meter or so across. They're just basically going to burn up, and they're not going to cause too much damage.
Okay. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Show came to a conclusion after 12 years, and I know that you've only seen it here now and again. I'm talking about the Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
But this is a show that, again, brought science to the masses. Would you agree with that?
I would definitely agree with that. I mean, so in the UK, there was this whole theory that there was an increase in the number of students studying physics at university because of the Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? We never saw such a blip here.
No.
Funnily enough, we actually have our biggest cohort in physics and astronomy we've ever had in St. Mary's this particular year, right? And we don't know why. I mean, I would love to say it's all of the great outreach we do, but I'm sure it isn't. I'm sure it's just statistical. And so we didn't ever really see a huge blip in the number of students coming through for us, but certainly people have reported this and written papers about it, if you can believe that, in the UK. So I liked the fact that it brought science to people in sort of like kitschy and fun way.
Yeah, yeah.
The fun was really an important part of it. Not so sure I liked all the stereotypes though, but no. I get why they did that as well. Yeah.
They got to try to entertain as well as educate.
Yeah, no, right? I know. So it's always funny though when people sort of like say, well, what do you do? And I go, well, I'm an astrophysicist. And they go, well, you don't look like an astrophysicist. So I go, well, what does an astrophysicist look like? Right?
Yeah. So. But anyway, it was a good show and had a great run. And again, I think it did a great deal to get people interested and paying attention to science.
No, I think I would have loved to have been able to contribute a few bits and things to the script, sort of do a few more things of how sort of the stuff that we do does impact people's daily lives a little bit more. But no, it's been a lot of fun. And like I said, when it first came out, my wife and I were watching it. And then after a while, we're like, oh, we've seen it. So.
But I don't believe then there's any real kind of outside of PBS, any kind of science show that, again, does the same kind of thing, you know, make it kind of more attractive to the masses.
I would tend to agree with that. I mean, so if you were going to point to the two shows over the last, let's give us four decades, that have had any real kind of impact, then you would probably say from the comedy perspective, it's Big Bang Theory. And then from the factual perspective, it's got to be Cosmos.
Yeah, I was going to say Carl Sagan and Cosmos.
Yeah, it's got to be Cosmos. Yeah. I mean, that was like cult when it was running. It was just amazing. It was the most expensive PBS series ever made at the time, I believe. So it was not a surprise that it was such a big impact. And the thing with Sagan was he was quite a poet.
Yeah.
Right.
That was a good show, Cosmos. And again, Carl Sagan did a lot to educate us all about what's going on up there in the big space beyond this planet of ours.
Well, one of my, one of the former students, I should say, she's graduated. She was a really good student. And she had a t-shirt with Carl Sagan's face and then WWCSD. And I'm like, what's that? It was, what would Carl Sagan do?
Very good. Yeah. Dr. Rob, good to see you again. Thank you very much for another interesting, fascinating
That's an hour already.
It does
good Lord.
Fly right by, doesn't it? Okay. You'll be back with us again next week, sir.
Absolutely.
Dr. Rob Thacker and Science Files with us here on a Monday morning. Thank you, Dr. Rob. It is now 2 minutes before 11 o'clock. This day is flying by, I tell you that. We're going to take a break here for a news update, and then it's your turn to sound off in the next hour. It's time for Manic Monday, and that means anything goes, and our phone lines await your calls, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Got something to say this morning? I'd love to hear from you. Give us a call. And we'll be back to take your calls after the news, and it is coming up next.